It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right. Plenty to cover this week, as
usual. Oh, yeah. Quite a week.
Quite a week. As I anticipate, they will be getting busier and busier as time goes on. Hey, let's start with the immigrant rights marches.
Yeah. It was not, as the Stranger had in its headline, the illegal immigrant march. There was a vast number of legal citizens in that march as well, as was true all across the country. I've heard estimates of up to 40,000 here in town, which I would very much believe. And there were a bunch also. The only total that I saw, the real estimate at a total, was actually given in by The Independent, a UK newspaper. I didn't see it anywhere in the US. I might have missed it, but they estimated 2 million people in 140 cities, which is, you know, pretty impressive. That includes 500,000 in D.C., 125,000 in New York at the City Hall March, which was one of three in town, plus another across the river in front of the Statue of Liberty in Jersey. We had 100,000 in Phoenix, 50,000 in Atlanta and Houston, 10,000 in Boston, which, you know, is probably 25. 3,000, my favorite of all of this, 3,000 people in Garden City, Kansas, which is like 25,000 people. You know, proportionately, that's actually probably the most impressive march I've heard of so far. There were marches in San Diego, Fresno, Oakland, Sacramento, Jackson, Mississippi. You know, the list just goes on and on. Over the previous weekend, there was 500,000 in Dallas. There was a big march in Boise, of all places, Des Moines, Iowa. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And it was remarkably effective politically. It has completely changed, not just the debate on the immigration bills in the House and Senate, but the political calculations of the Republicans and Democrats, because neither of them ever saw this coming. The Hispanic vote went 40% to George Bush in 2004. If Kerry had gotten as many Hispanic votes as Al Gore had, he would be president today. The Republicans have made a real effort to make inroads, for example, on Spanish language talk radio, which has been the force behind a lot of these marches here in Seattle. On Monday morning, I was listening to the 1360 out of Tacoma, the 1490 in Bremerton, the 1540 in Bellevue. All of them have good signals in, you know, different parts of Seattle. They were all promoting the march. That was the point at which I knew it was going to be a pretty big deal. And, you know, the same thing has happened in almost all of these other cities where the Spanish language radio is just banded together and really talked it up. There have been a lot of social networks involved in this. People have been using cell phones to organize, interestingly enough. Nobody's really reported on that. But anyway, the Democrats and Republicans both recognize that the immigrant vote is up for grabs. The Republicans have done a really good job of alienating the immigrants and Latinos who might have voted for them in 2004, because they had two competing proposals, one of which was a proposal by corporations to screw the guest workers. The other was a proposal by the xenophobes to, you know, kick everybody out or throw them in jail as a felony and build a big wall. Nobody seemed to seriously consider that these people are actually human beings. And what Americans saw on the news this week is people who love the country, want to be here, in many cases risked everything in order to be here, and are enormous contributors to the economy of the United States. So it's really going to change the debate. And I think there's some interesting lessons there for people who want to protest the policies of George Bush as well, whether it's the war in Iraq or the endemic corruption or any of a half dozen other issues we seem to talk about every week. You know, the idea that rather than talking about what America is doing wrong, you know, talk about the fact that we love the country and we want it back. It's been hijacked by these, you know, Machiavellian-filled oil patch executives, and they're wrecking the country. And we don't want to see that happen. We want to see George Bush out of office, and we want to see the country return to its rightful owners, namely us. because we love the country. And I think that kind of a positive message just works much better. There's a lot to be learned from these marches. The next one, the next big national day, including the next big march in here in Seattle, is on May 1st, May Day. Privately, apparently, Police Chief Gil Kurokowski is estimating that that march will draw at least 50,000. So I think we should start doing our best, number one, to make sure that that's an underestimate, and number two, that next time it's not just the immigrants that are there, that there's a much larger contingent of Anglos showing their support for immigrant rights and for a multi-ethnic, diverse United States at that march on May 1st.
Yeah, it was really inspiring.
It was, very much so.
All right, moving along. Looks like the city is looking at a compromise with ShareWheel.
Yeah, very good news. We've talked about this several times on this program. ShareWheel has been involved in a steadily escalating confrontation with the city of Seattle over the last several months over its refusal to implement a program called Safe Harbors, which is basically a demographic data collection program that the city is trying to institute for all of its homeless shelter providers. ShareWheel, of course, is the largest, it takes names, it takes social security numbers, it takes medical history, it takes domestic abuse history, drug and alcohol use, all sorts of things that are invasions of privacy, all sorts of things that can be used against people who want nothing more than a roof over their heads for the night. And ShareWheel, which is run collectively by and for homeless people at its 14 shelters and the 10 cities, and I think there's a women's emergency weather shelter, and they refuse to do it for any number of good reasons. Number one, because homeless people actually run those shelters, so the people collecting the data and who have that kind of intimate knowledge would be sleeping side by side with their colleagues. It just posed all sorts of problems. The compromise, which is brokered to its great credit by St. Mark's, has ShareWheel collecting aggregate data and giving it to the city, in some cases, depending on what the data is, monthly, in other cases, quarterly. They're still trying to hammer out some of the details, but that's the basic framework, and ShareWheel's very happy with the results, reportedly. And it's good news because it means the city will not lose for at least the next 2 years of its funding. The city's the largest and most cost-effective and most democratic shelter provider.
All right. Moving along, we were going to cover it last week, but didn't get to it. The Port of Seattle is looking at paying its people a little bit more.
Yeah, this is very, very interesting because it didn't get much attention when this came out, but a week ago Thursday, John Creighton, who, if people remember, he's the guy who ousted Lawrence Molloy, who was the only reform-minded person on the incredibly corrupt Port of Seattle Commission, the Port of Seattle being one of these back-scratching agencies where they hand out enormous corporate welfare, basically, to the shipping companies and cruise lines and so forth that do business with it. Pat Davis, of course, has been there for many years, the architect of the WTO ministerial. They're virulently free trade and promoted every chance that they get. It's not a politically neutral organization either. Anyway, the Port of Commission commissioner seat is actually a part-time seat that only pays $6,000 a year. And there's no spending limit on the campaign contributions that commissioners can take in order to get elected. So what happens is the only people who can afford to be commissioners are these, retired executives from the companies that the port is doing business with, stevedores and the shipping companies and so forth. And that's what happens. And John Creighton was a big business candidate who spent a truckload of money and ousted the only real reform-minded member of the Port of Seattle Commission. Well, we found out what that means at this particular meeting a couple weeks ago when Creighton unveils a discussion to have the Port of Seattle Commission commissioner's seat become a full-time proposition, which, by itself might be a good thing because it could attract people who actually don't have independent sources of wealth to be able to serve on the seat. But he wanted the salary to be potentially what Seattle City Council members make, which is $97,000 to $100,000 a year. By comparison, the Port of Seattle staff was actually asked to do a survey of 70 other publicly managed ports in the United States. Their governing boards of only a handful of those pay more to their board members than what the port commissioners make now, the $6,000. Of the ones in Washington State, I think it showed that Tacoma paid $10,000. I think Olympia was a little bit higher, and that was it. Everybody else was lower. And the same is true at other West Coast ports. So this kind of a salary is completely unprecedented in port management anywhere in the United States. And they're seriously talking about it at the port of Seattle. And it's, you know, it's just another opportunity to feather the bed of these people who are not only enriching their patrons, but now looks like they're talking about enriching themselves as well. And it just needs a little more attention. Mm-hmm. Because if there's not public attention over this, it becomes much more likely that it will happen.
All right, moving along. Hu Jintao is coming to town.
Yes. Hu Jintao, for people who are not up on their international relations, is the president of China. He's also the head of the Chinese Communist Party. And he's doing a state visit this coming week to the United States, meeting with President Bush on the April 20th. And the preceding 2 days, the 18th and 19th, he's going to be here in Seattle. He's going to be meeting with officials at Boeing, which, of course, opened the door for major U.S. trade with China by leaning heavily on the and lobbying heavily for the U.S. government to bestow most permanent most favored nation trading status with China in the 1990s, and then membership to WTO in 2001. They're also meeting with Microsoft, which of course has been a major factor in allowing the Chinese government to censor the internet. There's going to be a lot of publicity around this locally. And there was, for example, just a priceless quote this morning in the PI, which had the first advance coverage of his visit that I've seen, where, quote, lawmakers are voicing concerns about this regarding our China policy, about national security, the trade deficit, and growing competition. Well, that's very true, and you could also add to that list that military hawks in the Pentagon, along with military hawks in China, are also moving toward the sort of mutual Cold War that we had with the Soviet Union for 50 years. But nowhere on that list is human rights violations, and China is the worst, one of the, probably in terms of sheer scale, the worst human rights violator in the world. Period. There's talk of concentration camps and slave labor, particularly for Falun Gong practitioners, who will have a protest on Monday at Westlake. We'll talk about it at the end of the hour. There's enormous numbers of political prisoners. Most of the leaders of the Tiananmen Square revolt in 1989 have now been scattered to the wind. As I mentioned, there's tremendous censorship of the internet. There's, in fact, a thriving business going on in China of anti-censorship software that can try to subvert the government controls. It's a very totalitarian society in the way that it is run, and now it has become totalitarian and capitalist. But that doesn't mean it's not still totalitarian. That just needs to be talked about more, especially by the progressive left. The only people consistently voicing concern about human rights violations in China, in this country, tend to be Christians, tend to be hard conservative rights. And, you know, progressives who care about human rights and whatnot need to be talking more about China, because some really, really bad things are going on there. And Hu Jintao's visit to Seattle is an excellent opportunity to start talking about that.
All right. If it's okay with you, I want to skip to national, and if we have time, come back to the couple other local things.
Sure.
Donald Rumsfeld getting a lot of extra attention in the media this week.
Yeah, a couple interesting things. Salon had a report yesterday, salon.com, saying that there's new evidence, and I'll just read this, that Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was intimately involved, I love that phrasing, in sexual prisoner abuse at the Guantanamo Bay, I almost said concentration camp. That would be a slip, wouldn't it? According to a December 20th, 2004 Army Inspector General's report on Major General Jeffrey Miller, the former commanding general in charge of Gitmo. And remember, he was also the person who was then shipped to run and reform the interrogation processes at Abu Ghraib. Rumsfeld approved an interrogation plan for Mohammed al-Qahtani, the alleged 20th hijacker. And you thought it was the guy being tried in Virginia right now. It's almost like, you know, who's al-Qaeda, bin Laden's second in command. There's plenty of those too. In a sworn statement to the inspector general, Lieutenant General Randall Schmidt described Rumsfeld as, quote, personally involved in the interrogation, and said that the defense secretary was, quote, talking weekly with Miller. Rumsfeld developed an interrogation plan that required the Gitmo detainee to, quote, stand naked in front of a female interrogator. He was accused of being a homosexual and was forced to wear women's underwear and to perform, quote, dog tricks on a leash. Schmidt said that the open-ended policies Rumsfeld approved, and that the apparent lack of supervision of day-to-day interrogations permitted the widespread future abuse to take place. The report directly contradicts Rumsfeld's earlier public statements. So Rumsfeld may now be in trouble over that. At the meantime, there is, you could almost call it, an open revolt among the senior leadership of the United States military. We have now 7 very senior retired generals of the armed forces in the United States who have openly called for Donald Rumsfeld's resignation. A number of them came out this week. Retired Marine Corps General Anthony Zinni, who's been a longtime critic of the war in Iraq and is kind of leading the effort, Major General Charles Swanick, Major General John Riggs, Major General John Batiste, Marine Corps Lieutenant General Gregory Newbold, who had the essay in Time this week calling on active duty people to come out and speak their minds also, Major General Paul Eaton, Lieutenant General Paul Van Riper, and, you know, And of course, you have George Bush saying in response to all this that Rumsfeld is doing, quote, a very fine job, which is an insult to the intelligence of every single American. But the remarkable thing about this is that these folks are speaking out at all. There's a very strong, ingrained culture in the military of deferring to civilian leadership. This Constitution of the United States specifically puts civilians in charge of the military so that you don't have the danger of the military as an independent political force, so that you don't have the danger of a coup d'etat. And this kind of speaking out, which wouldn't be happening unless people who are in active service, who are duty-bound not to speak out but to follow the orders of the commander-in-chief, it wouldn't be happening unless they felt the same way, just the same way that John Murtha 6 months ago wouldn't have been speaking out were there not these kind of sentiments among the senior Pentagon leadership. This kind of speaking out, it happened in the run-up to the Civil War. That, I think, is the only other example in the history of the United States where you have this kind of an open revolt by, or criticism, actually is a better term, by people in the senior military leadership of their civilian leadership. And of course, the criticism of Rumsfeld is also, at least in part, a criticism of Bush. So it's a very, very significant and scary development.
All right. And give us a Wilson scandal update.
Yeah. Murray Wass of the National Journal, who's a very credible, somewhat conservative commentator who's broken some stories on this before, has a report yesterday that Dick Cheney directed Scooter Libby to leak Valerie Plame's name literally within the hour before Wilson went ahead and revealed the name to Judith Miller, then of the New York Times. So we have, and this was according both to according to Murray Wass, according both to testimony given in Fitzgerald's probe and also to other people familiar with the case. So he's got it doubly or triply sourced. So again, Cheney is in this just up to his neck, and it's pretty clearly illegal. We have a special prosecutor looking into it who's got this testimony taken under oath. I think Cheney's in a world of legal trouble right now.
All right. And also this week, info came out about a report that had gone to the White House about those mobile weapons labs.
Yeah, this was in 2003. And this was George Bush saying, "We have found the weapons of mass destruction," which ought to, you know, rank right up there with "nobody anticipated a breach of the levees" as one of his famous statements. These were basically the trailers that were used for weather balloons. And for months and months after this, the Bush administration was peddling this as mobile bioweapons labs, which, you know, I can remember Ramiro Tomczyk on this show at the time ridiculing that claim and talking about all the potholes on the roads in Iraq, particularly after, you know, all the years of economic sanctions and, you know, no money and no equipment to repair the roads. The idea that you could have sensitive chemical or biological weapons and sensitive equipment being prepared, being worked on as it bounced down these pothole, you know, ridden roads, rather than, say, putting it on a rail car, which might make some sense. You know, it is just preposterous. It was ridiculous at the time for anybody who knew anything about Iraq. Now we have confirmation that President Bush was told by the Defense Intelligence Agency 2 days before he started making the public claims that, in fact, the trailers had nothing whatsoever to do with these weapons. So, again, we find out that Bush is lying. Much more interesting, actually, is the rationale that the White House is using for now. Another report came out, which was saying that, well, yeah, they had the DIA report, but Bush hadn't seen it because it took so long to declassify. Well, remember that just the last week when we talked about the leak of the National Intelligence Estimate on Iraq, where the defense was that it couldn't have been a leak because President Bush has the sole personal authority to declassify classified documents based on his verbal say-so. So why didn't he do the same thing with the Defense Intelligence Agency report? Why did it take days and days and days to declassify that when Bush could wave his hand and do the same thing? So, you know, they're lying through their teeth on this one, as they are on so many other things. It's just more confirmation.
Briefly, Cy Hirsch had an article in The New Yorker this last
Yeah,
week.
It's the current issue of The New Yorker. It's online. I urge people to read it. It's one of the scariest things you'll read for a while. He's reporting both that Bush is intent on regime change in Iran, that plans for not only military strikes, but a possible war are moving forward, and that use of tactical nuclear weapons to reach some of their underground nuclear facilities are still under active consideration. And of course, the White House issued the usual round of denials, but the report's being taken. Actually, they didn't deny it. They called it wild speculation, but they didn't deny it. This report's being taken very seriously, and there are a lot of indications that this is exactly what the White House is doing, is marching full speed ahead toward war with Iran, without bothering to check with either Congress or the American public, you know, trying to ramp up a manufactured crisis with a country that's, by most credible estimates, 5 to 10 years away from having any kind of nuclear weapon. Stephen Rademacher, who is the very conservative replacement for John Bolton as the Bush administration's non-proliferation guy, saying this week that Iran could produce enough enriched uranium for nuclear weapon in 2 weeks. Well, not only is that preposterous, but that's a very specific propaganda ploy to make people think that Iran could produce a nuclear weapon in 2 weeks. It's just the sort of rhetorical bullshit that, excuse me, I probably shouldn't have said that word.
You probably shouldn't have.
But it's just the sort of thing that was used in the run-up to Iraq, and we should not be fooled again if we were ever fooled the first time.
All right. Italy has a new prime minister.
Yes, Romano Prodi is the John Kerry of Italy, but he actually managed to beat Silvio Berlusconi. And this means a couple of interesting things. Number one, the remaining Italian troops in Iraq are going to be pulled out as soon as the new prime minister assumes office. Even more interesting, because there weren't that many Italian troops left, Berlusconi pulled them out over the last year because of so much domestic opposition, and he wanted to be reelected. But there's a very interesting case, which I think I talked about on this program a few weeks ago, of a 2003 kidnapping kidnapping of a Muslim cleric suspected of terrorist ties. The CIA kidnapped him off the streets of Milan, and Milan prosecutors have now charged 22 CIA agents who were just, you know, comically inept at disguising what they were doing. He has charged them and is seeking their extradition on kidnapping charges. Now, this guy was shipped off to Egypt to be interrogated, and he was tortured there. So this is another one of the rendition operations. Now, the extradition request and subsequent trial, which can take place whether the extradition is honored or not, has been blocked by the conservative Berlusconi government. But under Pondi, it's likely to move forward. So we're going to see, almost certainly, a trial of these 22 CIA operatives in Milan, and it's going to be very, very interesting. That's a direct result of the Italian election this week.
All right. And in Spain, they had some developments with the bombing that had occurred there?
Yeah, the Madrid bombing in 2004, where a lot of people in the subway system were killed. Spain indicted 29 people associated with that bombing this week. None of them had ties to Al-Qaeda, unlike what initially Spain and certainly the Bush administration has claimed. Is very similar, in fact, to the bombings in London last summer, where it was homegrown Muslims who were upset about the country's role in the war in Iraq. And they killed a lot of people.
All right. And speaking of bombing, Israel did some bombing this week?
Oh, yeah. A lot of shelling is going on of civilian populations in Gaza. There's also a lot of starvation going on in Gaza because Israel is very tightly controlling the entry points. There's only three of them to the Gaza Strip from Israel. And, of course, the border with Egypt has been closed by Israel for a long time. People in the Gaza Strip are in desperate straits. The Palestinians have appealed to the UN Security Council so far to no avail. A couple dozen at least Palestinians have died just in the last few days from these shellings, and there's been absolutely no U.S. media coverage. There's been virtually complete silence. This is a huge story in Europe. It's a huge story in the Middle East. Remember that United States support for Israel, its unquestioning support and large financial support, is the linchpin of Muslim hatred for the United States in the Middle East, even more so than Iraq, even more so than a threatened war with Iran. And yet we don't hear anything about it here. And right now we're building toward another major crisis.
And very briefly, Iraq.
Yeah. We have now 32 U.S. soldiers having died so far this month in Iraq. That's more than the entire month of March. So the trend over the last several months of declining U.S. soldier deaths as the sectarian violence becomes more pronounced has been reversed this month. A lot of those deaths in Anbar province, where there isn't as much sectarian violence simply because it's an all-Sunni population. But the sectarian violence, of course, is continuing to rise also. So it's very much spinning out of control there. We have three U.S. Marines decommissioned from a unit being investigated for the killing of 15 civilian Iraqis in the town of Haditha last November. That massacre is not being given much attention in the U.S. And we had an organization based in London called the Mercer Human Resources Consulting that does an annual survey of livability of world cities that ranked Baghdad the worst city in the world in which to live this year. Zurich, by the way, finished top.
All right. Events happening this weekend and coming week.
Yeah. Monday, I mentioned at 2:30, there will be a Falun Gong protest of Chinese civil rights taking place at Westlake Park downtown. Also downtown on Monday, it's tax day. There will be war tax resistors and people objecting as to what's being done with our tax dollars in various places in the Middle East. Leafleting. I know of at least two sessions, one at 12, one at 5 o'clock. There will be other post office leafleting going on around town for information on where, give a call to 206-547-0952. It's a nonviolent action community of Cascadia, or www.seanacc.org would have that information. Thursday is the annual meeting of Weyerhaeuser. Rainforest Action Network is launching a protest there. I don't have time, location information on that. I haven't seen it, but apparently you can look up www.searag.org and they will post it there. And then a reminder once again that Eat the State is having a benefit coming up with David Barsamian. He's going to be in town the weekend of the 29th and 30th. On the 30th, he'll be speaking with us at University Baptist Church at 6:30 p.m. Suggested donation $5 to $15. Please help us out. It'd be great to see you all there.
All right. Talking once again with Job Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State, and just give the quick contact info.
Okay. Yeah. Out of time. Eat the State, it comes out every couple of weeks. Volunteer organization. Help out. Give feedback. Whatever you want to do. Give us a call at 706-719-6947 or look us up on the web, and the issues, of course, are all there also, www.eatthestate.org.